Welcome to session five. And our first presenters this afternoon are Sherry Wells Jensen, Jason Wells Jensen, Lucas Fullenkamp with a presentation on involving students in meaningful language preservation work as early as possible.
Thank you for coming back from lunch, everyone. We'll try not to put you all the way to sleep. The way we have this arranged amongst ourselves today is sort of, we have our technology guru over here is gonna flip slides for us, and Jason is gonna start each slide, and I'm gonna sort of kibitz along the way. And we apologize for having the clunkiest, least easy to read title in the conference as far as we can. We worked on it for a while and really got nowhere to make it pithy sounding, so. Okay. Don't worry, I hadn't been saying anything super interesting up to this point, so if you didn't hear it, it's probably just fine. Okay, Jason, do you want to read that title or just we just go
no,
ahead?
Let's go ahead. So our experience, here's our situation, and I will be more or less summarizing what it says on the slide, and Sherry will be adding detail. Our experience has been working on a couple of projects over the last several years with the Mingo Nation United Remnant Band, members of which live in Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia, and with speakers of Oroha from the Solomon Islands. And we thank both of those communities for their patience and for the opportunity to work with them on their languages.
And we also need to thank Jordan Letchler, who is the person who got us connected with these folks and allowed us to do this work in the first place. So both of us are linguists in an English department, and as far as I can tell, we're pretty much the only linguists in our building. There are sort of language-interested people, and there are English as a second language teachers who are, many of them, de facto linguists, but we are the sort of only two folks who claim that title.
Here's the problem. There's a mismatch between the amount of work to be done and the number of people willing and able to do the work, or the number of people apparently willing and able to do the work. But one of the resources we're looking at today is the number of eager but untrained introductory students who might be able to help.
So we get into, everyone who's ever taught an interlinguistics class knows either the graduate or undergraduate level. You talk about morphemes and they go, yeah, and you talk about phonetics and yeah, and they talk about phonology and they go, whatever. And then you start talking about sociolinguistics and particularly language death and the whole class just comes alive and people are fascinated and concerned, and for many of them their immediate reaction is, oh please can I help, and they're very excited and they're very enthusiastic and they want it badly, and they feel, even some of them, like, this could be the work that I'm called to do and I really want to participate. And then traditionally what we've had to say to them is, that's lovely and welcome and please take the morphology class and the phonetics class and the syntax class and two semantics classes and then get back to me. And by the time, in many cases, they get done with that sequence, and in our case, we don't even have that sequence to send them to because we don't have that many linguistics courses. But by the time they are traditionally considered ready to work, sometimes they're gone, sometimes their enthusiasm has died out, and we want to get them when they're really ready.
Okay, we'll skip over that later. So here's a couple of specific goals. One is to include more people in individual language preservation projects, at the same time maintaining a respectful attitude and not losing efficiency, but increasing the involvement and diversifying the involvement as much as possible, and increasing further the number of students who might decide to become involved more deeply in language preservation over the long term. To increase also along the way the diversity of workers involved in language preservation and the number of meaningful opportunities, because we are primarily educators, to increase meaningful opportunities for students to get involved in whatever we're doing.
One of the most disappointing things I think that can happen to a student who's really really excited is to be told, yeah, you can come to language preservation, here, make the coffee. And to give them a trivial task that doesn't speak to their determination and their desire to help is another way to shut them down completely. So we want to, whatever participation they have, we want it to really be on task and meaningful for them.
Sherry has already sort of talked about the couple of these additional challenges. Certainly the first one, students are initially excited, but that excitement can die down if you don't grab onto it. Second, from the point of view of the experienced linguist, there may be an attitude that having an untrained assistance can really create extra work for the person in charge rather than the other way around.
I think, though, that what we found, as and you'll see this as we go forward, is that students really quickly understand the difference between an academic hoop to jump through, you have to complete this worksheet, who cares, there's no consequences. In some cases, that's the way they feel. They understand that as contrasted with, this is a real task affecting real people in the real world, and working with within a community changes their approach rapidly from, I have these tasks to complete to get my grade, to I really want to do this well, and I really want to be a responsible team member.
An additional challenge is that students often don't have resources to travel to do field work. Finally, if the work is part of an academic class, another sort of mismatch between the way that academic work is often traditionally done and what we're talking about is you can do sort of semi-adequate work and get a C and pass the class and be done if what you're talking about is an academic class. But in a real life situation where there's real work to be done affecting other people, you really want, you need A work from everybody all the time.
I think that the other thing that I would add to this is, it's really clear to me that we can admit that there might in fact be errors in our published work. We can admit that, yeah, we did that dictionary, we did that paper, and maybe there were some things wrong with it, and we can admit that for ourselves. What's more difficult for us is to allow other people, meaning our students, the same grace to, may I make an occasional mistake. None of the work that we produce, either as individuals or as a team involving students, is going to be perfect. And that illusion that we can, if we would just get those students out of the way, do something perfect, it really is an illusion. We're never going to make anything that's 100% accurate, no matter who does it. And so if we focus a little more along the path and the methods, we might in fact have something that's more accurate than we would have had we insisted on being in control of it the whole way ourselves.
So here's a variety of strategies that can help overcome these challenges and welcome students into the world in the work of language revitalization. Divide the teaching. So in a language camp situation with the Mingo Nation United Remnant Band, when we had no native speaker, the goal here was to teach the language to people who had not grown up with it, children and adults. And so in this case, there was no native speaker, there was no single person who was the expert on the language in the situation physically. So instead of having one of us do most of the teaching, we divided the material.
So we took a bunch of students, some of my grad students who are English as a second language teachers who wanted to get involved. And we said, look, here's your small level of expertise. And we drilled them and worked with them intensively and were able to offer to the community a set of people, each of which sort of had one piece of the puzzle. So one person had, you know, some of the plant words, and another person had some of the animal words, and another person had some phrases, and no one had to learn it all. And these teachers, our students, then could teach their small level of expertise over and over again to community members who were interested specifically in their area.
Another solution is utilize the skills that the students have. And this is true, of course, for not just for students, but for anyone involved in any project that you're working on. Find out what they're good at, emphasize those strengths, make maximal use of those strengths. We had students with artistic background or journalism background who could help with pedagogical materials, with proofreading, with various other. Oh, I see. This note says it was necessary to proofread after the setup work was done. And again, this goes both ways. I think going back to what Sherry said a few moments ago, we are not, just because we're professionals with PhDs or whatever, we're not going to do everything perfectly. Having an additional set of eyes to look over what you've written is always useful for anyone at any level. So when the students do work, we check it. When we do work, it may be possible that students will catch an error for us as well.
So some of this philosophy comes to us from conflict resolution literature. So we don't want to include, we don't want to confuse our goal, which is get more of the language spoken, get more of the language taught, with specific means that we've devised ourselves. So we might think right now that we know kind of how to proceed in any language situation, but when we look around and see who our team members are, then we have a different way, perhaps, of assessing the situation and deciding what we're going to do to reach our goal. So the analogy might be, so if you have a couch that needs moved or it's bothering you where it is, you can, if you happen to have four big strong people, you can have them move it, or you can, if you happen to have some money, you can pay someone to move it, or if you happen to have an axe and you don't mind the mess, you can chop it up and move it in pieces, or you can reupholster it and then have a couch that you like. And in the end, you meet your same goal. The irritating couch is gone from your situation. But how you do that depends on who the people are around you and what resources those people have and what their strengths are.
And there are a few more examples. We had some students with acting ability, musical ability, obviously could contribute in various ways to the teaching situation. We also had, of course, as mentioned earlier, we had some linguistic students and some education students who had various perspectives on the pedagogical materials and the ability to test them and check them out.
So this was actually really terrific fun, and our students, even some of those students who didn't think they wanted to be involved in language revitalization, really liked this part. So when we had a couple of sample lessons that we thought, well, I think this will work, and in my case, I often devise lessons, and later I think, oh, that wasn't really great. That I didn't think of these nine things that went wrong. So we would just take our classes, whatever class it was, and say, hey, today, gang, we're all going to learn a few phrases, and this, we're going to learn this dialogue in Orhan, so hang on tight, here we go. And so we would teach the lesson to our students, just whoever happened to be in the, you know, linguistics 101 class, and we saw sort of how it went. They had a good time. It raised their consciousness about the issues of language preservation, and then we got some really useful feedback about how we presented the lesson and what things in the language proved barriers to them in terms of getting the language spoken and being able to use it with ease.
Of course, there are various technological approaches, Skype and so forth, working with consultants doing field work long distance when we're unable to travel. This makes the work more accessible for everyone. Also, the fact that we're incorporating various new technologies into what we do means that people who have skills working or comfort working with those new technologies can always help. Recording and editing audio and video, conversion of files to various formats as needed, setting up databases, setting up web pages, are all things that you don't have to have linguistics training at all in order to be helpful with.
So one of the other kind of ancillary goals that we feel is important when we're doing this work is to let the community at large, so in our case, meaning literature faculty in the English building, know that this sort of work is going on and that it's important, and giving them some sense of what it means. And if you are Skyping with someone and your office door happens to be open and you're playing some kind of language game or you're telling some kind of crazy story and people are laughing and exclaiming things, it rapidly sort of becomes apparent to everyone that something unusual is going on. And it makes a difference, I think, for everyone to know that that these situations exist and that this is something that we all have to pay attention to and can learn from.
And then one of our solutions, of course, is training and finding out what is the minimal amount of training that we can do, or what kinds of training can we do to zero in on getting students up to speed quickly and able to help with linguistic tasks. So one of the examples here is we're building the Oroha Dictionary. We were able to give students some guidelines about what a possible word is in Oroha. They learned which consonant clusters are not possible, which sounds can end a word, what letters can be doubled when writing the word in the orthographic system we're using. And with this knowledge, they can help with proofreading. Again, without knowing a lot about the language itself, without having specific linguistic skills, there are still things that they can do in the process of building a dictionary that are extremely useful.
So one of my computer programming friend said, you know, I could just write you a script that would go through and kind of look at those words, and you don't have to have all those students doing all that work. And it made me think that, well, yeah, we could do that. We could automate that process. And then I thought that, well, really, the best path to the goal is not always the straightest path. And we do have a responsibility as educators, not just to do our research and not just to work on these languages, but also to broaden the scope of influence that we have and to really teach people these skills. So it is less efficient in some ways to simultaneously do two things, which is include the students and have the students do this work and get the work done. But I think in the end, it will turn out to be more overall, more effective overall.
A few additional things. Students served as backup note takers during elicitation sessions. They looked through our Oraha dictionary to find missing words, concepts that we probably should have had a word for that just didn't seem to be there. To help us keep track of what information we wanted to find during the next elicitation session. Students also conducted some of the elicitation sessions in conjunction with faculty or trained linguists or people with more training. And of course, there's things like writing grants, which again, requires little or no linguistics background per se, but is extremely helpful.
One of the things that's worked really well for us is just getting the students in the door and including them in everything we do as best as we can. And one of the things that, maybe it's just my set of students, but they like it when I say, okay, now when I forget something, you please, you know, tell us what it is we're forgetting. And being able to, because everyone forgets something sometime, right? And being able to contribute just brings them right into the team. And when you have a team, things can always sort of go better.
Yeah, this is the community reaction slide. I'm just going to hand it over to you.
Okay. So one of the things that we really worried about a lot was the community saying to us, this is really great for you that your students come in and use us for your purposes to educate your students. And we were really concerned that people would feel like our whole attention wasn't on them or like we were cheating or using them in some kind of way that made everybody feel uncomfortable. And we worried a lot about offending people, and then we decided that we would just worry about trying hard not to be offensive and just do the job in the right spirit and with humility offer the resources that we have to the communities. And one of the big untapped resources that we have all around us are these very enthusiastic and interested and willing students. And when we offer that resource with a good spirit and humbly, we find that communities are very willing to welcome them in, and that they don't have this sense of hierarchy generally that academia has, that you are the professor and here are the students and here are the undergraduate students, and we should assign responsibility thinking about the people's roles within that strict hierarchy. If we break that hierarchy and allow whoever has talent to participate, find that the communities are perfectly willing and they graciously have welcomed us. We've never heard anyone, well, you know, lots anyway. And when we have heard complaints, it's not about, hey, what are those students doing here? And in any relationship, there are always little bumps, right? But it's never been the fact that we welcome students onto the team that has caused conflict between us and the folks that we are so lucky to work with.
This philosophy that guides inclusion of students is viewing our group, our research group, our training group, our fieldwork group as a community. Each member has different strengths and weaknesses, and we all help each other. There's more room for diversity in how things are done. There's a potential for more work to get done. And as they are included as equal participants, we have less trouble with sloppy work, because the students buy into the task that they're doing and own it and take it seriously because they understand that it's real. It's real work. It's not just an academic exercise for them. Okay, that's, yeah.
So I was thinking when we were getting ready to present that the way that we ended up putting our presentation together is sort of a meta representation, right? So nobody last night was panicking because that one person had to do a presentation tomorrow and they were scared, right? So all of us knew that we'd be able to work together, we'd be backing each other up, and we would be fine. And the way that we ended up putting our presentation together had a lot to do with who felt most comfortable doing what, and how we thought we could communicate the material. And it wasn't the presentation that I would have given on my own, and it wasn't the presentation that Lucas or Jason would have given on his own, but it turned out to be kind of a thing that emerged from all of us working together. And your situation will inevitably be really different. You'll have different kinds of students. And so I think that the take home for us has been, and what we'd like to offer to you, is that you have more resources than perhaps you think you do. And if you can let go of how you thought you were going to do the project and allow those resources to assist you in shaping a new project, you never quite know what will emerge, but it will be something wonderful. Thanks, we'd be happy to take questions. That's a really good question. So we had two things that we did. One was sort of linguistically, which we just sort of said, okay, here are the things to look for, and we made sure they had just a little bit of language training. But then what we did is we just asked one of the community members to talk with the students with us, so that it wasn't us telling them what they would expect, right? It was someone from the community working with us to come in, and we had the person come into a class and sort of meet the students. The students ask questions, and then we helped with the community member brainstorm, okay, what would really be bad if our students did it? Really, just tell me what the really bad things are so that I can tell them, be sure not to do these things, because they wouldn't necessarily think to tell us what the really bad things were. So we did that little brainstorming ahead of time, and then we allowed the community member to meet the students and just talk. We didn't presume to do most of that ourselves. We let the community do that. Different ways that we did this. So for testing the pedagogical material, we just used a class that we had. I have a group of grad students who are going to be English as a second language teachers, and some of them just decide they love this and want to participate. I've never tried to take 30 students and, you know, into a community. I think that would be really disruptive. But in general, 30 students don't want to go, right? There's some students that want to go.
So and you built it in as the, so if you had a student, for example, university studying, I don't know, video production, would you get them in your program?
Sometimes, if we have specifically gone looking for people that we needed. Most of the time we have students studying something related to linguistics doing in the intro class or in our ESL curriculum who turn out to have the skills. It's really sort of been a lot of serendipity. But we do know where to go get someone from biology if we need a consultation about plants that whose names we don't know.
So one sort of follow-up then, how do you evaluate that aspect? Because if, you know, you're in a university, you have to give a grade, presumably, for their activity. How did you handle that?
We do a lot of independent studies, to be honest. And we do a lot of, would you like to substitute participation in this research project for your final project in this class? We do a lot of that. Sometimes we have interns. We just say, here, sign up for an internship and do it. And I have done quite a bit of just swapping things out. Say, oh, you have to write a research paper? Well, don't. You do this instead.
So they're trained to teach language, because I know there are people who are teaching language who
certification programs for elementary school teachers. I don't let anybody, I mean, I try not to be too much of a gatekeeper, but I do feel it is my role to stand in between totally untrained people and a community in need, so that people aren't just playing games, right? So people really have skills to offer when they go in there. So I think, so we do have some training programs, and sometimes we get people from there.
I think it might be important to reiterate, in our situation, Sherry and I are trained as linguists, but we're working in an English department that does not have a linguistics program. So the language preservation work that we're doing is, it's incorporated into our academic work only as much as we can incorporate it. So the university itself is not formally offering linguistics training, and is not, does not even have a department that is, we don't even have an anthropology department, do we?
No, we don't.
And the communities that we're working with also are very small. And so they have very sort of specific needs, and to the extent that we think we can help address those needs, we do our best. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna, I'm just gonna talk about Lucas like he's not here, because that's what he just told me to do. So Lucas is, in fact, Lucas is the graduate student who works with me on a regular basis for whatever research I have going on. So he's involved in this work because he's a good match with me for the year. So sometimes it happens that way too.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.